Hello, welcome to episode 48 of the Chatter in Classes, where I talk to Duncan Driver about the Beatles at length. If you're not a fan of the Beatles, maybe we'll convince you otherwise. Probably not. I don't know. We like them. I might as well start. Let's start.
Okay.
This is episode 48. The Chattering Classes. I'm here with Duncan Driver again. We're talking the Beatles. We hinted at it at the start of the year. I think episode 40, you and Nick sat down with me and we had a little chat about our obsessions and the Beatles came up. So we knew we were going to get to this, and it's been put off mostly by me all of this time. And at the moment, I am looking at this beautiful white album, or The Beatles, as it's known. What is this?
The official title is The Beatles.
The Beatles, yeah.
Everyone calls it the White Album, and that popular title is so popular that even in official listings, it's The Beatles brackets The White Album.
So what am I looking at here is an enormous sort
of... It's the Super Deluxe Edition.
Right.
And as I was saying to you, I don't know how many were allocated to Australia, but... such editions as were allocated to Australia were exhausted in 3 days of this being announced.
Right.
So I'm one of the few people in this country who has one.
So it's six CDs in total?
Six CDs in total, including a Blu-ray.
So what's the Blu-ray of?
The Blu-ray has a 5.1 surround mix.
Right.
And it also has a direct transfer of the original mono mix. No video content, which
I was going to say.
I don't mind that much, because anything that they could put on there, I either already have or I know how to get quite easily.
Right.
But it's still, it's something that you think people would appreciate. I mean, and some people online I've heard making the argument, well, there isn't a lot of video that you could put on there in the first place, but there is still stuff.
I'm sure there is.
There's the Hey Jude and the Revolution promo films.
Yeah.
Something I would really have loved is a really cleaned up version of the Apple promo film.
Right.
Have you ever seen that?
I have seen bits in the very grainy.
Yeah.
Sort of.
But it's fascinating to watch.
Yeah.
And there's footage in there in Abbey Road of Paul recording Blackbird.
Mm.
And footage of them rehearsing Helter Skelter.
Right.
Golden footage, which would have been great to see really cleaned and polished up.
Yeah.
But no, nothing.
I don't know. Who knows? Maybe they're trying to work on it. Duncan's making me do this with special gloves on as well, so I'm not damaging at all, but it's very nice. And
I'm not precious about these things. It's not a holy relic.
It is a six CDs, but it's got lots of old... photos, which I don't think I've seen many of them before.
Yeah, a lot of them are new to me.
Explaining each song that's from the...
Yeah, there's a Trainspottery track-by-track analysis of all of the recording dates, which anyone who's got Lewison's Complete Beatles recording sessions knows already. But there's still some interesting information about the recording that is fresh.
Yeah, and we're recording this episode, was it 5 days? Is it the 20th? It is on here somewhere. The 22nd of November was the 50th anniversary.
Was the official release date, yeah.
I believe so. Fantastic. I'm going to...
Beatles were always very good at releasing product close to Christmas.
Yes.
They knew what they were doing.
Yes, they certainly did. And they did it every year, didn't they?
Rubber Soul was definitely a Christmas album.
Now, I would, in preparation for this, one of the things that freaked me out... and. I'm going to ask you this question while I'm telling this story, because this is from Mr. Nick Maniatis.
Okay.
Couldn't be with us tonight, but wrote in the listener mailbox.
Oh, great.
And he's got a couple of questions for us. But the first question he's got for us is, it says, I like the Beatles. I grew up listening. We don't believe him, no. I grew up listening to them because my dad loved them. My kids enjoy listening to them because I play them at home. I absolutely appreciate their contribution to the modern music as we know it, but I don't, in inverted commas, love them. What makes the Beatles so special to both of you? Is there a moment? Is there a memory?
Mm.
Is there a vignette? The smoke alarm goes off somewhere. Yeah. You can share that encapsulates your passion.
Okay.
But what I was going to say was, in preparation for this, or just maybe when this was released, there was a lot of chat about it. I looked up all the albums and when they were released, because I always get the Beatles and Magical Mystery Tour mixed up.
Right.
Like in the wrong order. And so I wanted to just see when it came out. Now, I know they were prolific in their releasing of work.
Mm.
But the thing that, the one thing that blew my brain apart was the fact that there were 4 months between Help and Rubber Soul.
Mm.
So in the early days, you can kind of hear, oh yeah, they're progressing and they're changing, but it's, you know, there
it's
might have
still
been
still Mott Top Beatles for a number of years, yeah, about half their career.
That's right.
At least their career is like international, famous, well-known recording
exactly
artists.
Right.
They're a very particular type of band.
Yeah, they call them like a beat, like the beat band.
Merseyside, Merseybeat, whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
So they do that and you can hear, all right, well, there's not much gap between, say, like A Hard Day's Night and Beatles for Sale. There's maybe a shift in tone, but it's not really that different. But when you get to something like Help, which is probably the last of the albums, sort of has Yesterday and a few other versions, but then 4 months later you just have this completely different, they're still touring. It's just incredible that they can in 4 months go, all right, now we're going to have this album that's completely different to anything not only we've done before, but that most of their fans would have heard before.
Mm.
A lot of it inspired by like folk, and a lot of it inspired by country, and a lot of it inspired by Dylan.
Mm.
And then just all of a sudden just shift. And that's something I could never...
Yeah.
The question that Nick's asking about why you love it.
That's definitely a part of it.
Yeah.
That's definitely a part of it. And you can extend that a little bit further. And yeah, it is extraordinary to put markers in place and say between this date and this date, this is how far they traveled.
Yeah.
And you compare that to pretty much any other band,
exactly,
either then
or
at any point since.
Yeah.
And there isn't anything like that level of progression.
Yeah.
But it's also thinking about the 7-year window in which they are active as recording artists, and in that 7 years, 14 albums, and an average of about 2 singles a year, which are non-album tracks.
Right.
That level of productivity and the level of quality amongst all of that, utterly unsurpassed by anyone else.
Yeah.
So that's definitely one way to answer the question, isn't it?
And I like to think of that. Like if you're thinking about that and you go, all right, well, what was I doing 7 years ago?
Yeah.
And it's not so much as well that they did it in 7 years, but at a really crucial 7-year period of anyone's life, that early 20s, it's like your 20s, that 7-year period where you can hear a progression of maturity and worldview.
Absolutely.
And all of these things changing, which happens in your 20s. This is my worldview. Oh, no, that's changed. I look back at myself 2 years ago and it's embarrassing or it's completely different. And now then I progress. And I love that the sort of creativity of the middle part of that being that Sgt. Pepper revolver, wild experimentation, sonic, like cram as much sonicscape into it. And then by the end of it, they're like, let's go a bit just back to sort of basic blues stuff, which I think happens in your 20s. I think you do all this and you try all this
and then you start to figure out who you are.
Yeah, and it sort of levels off. It's not as messy. It's not as all over the place. It's not as bright and colourful, maybe.
Yeah.
But by the end of it, you're a bit more level.
Mm.
And maybe you're closer to what your original stance was, but you've tried all this other stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I don't like who I am, so I'm going to change and be different. And then you're like, oh, you know what? By the end of my 20s, I've got to kind of accept this is who I am.
Yeah. I think one of the other ways to answer Nick's question, and it's probably true of a lot of great works of art, is that you experience it at different periods in your life and it says different things to you.
Oh, without a doubt,
The White Album is a classic example of that.
Yeah.
Because everyone who loves the White album and is fascinated by it has certain tracks on it that they can't stand and they will always skip over.
Very true.
Everyone recognizes that, as fascinating as it is,
yeah,
it has imperfections.
I might have written that down as one of the questions.
But what's really interesting to me is that the tracks that you consider to be imperfect actually change over time. And a lot of the ones that I couldn't stand when I was 16 are amongst my favorite ones now.
Right. And ones that I loved. Can you give an example of
that? Yeah. I was enamored of a lot of McCartney stuff early on.
Right.
I've always been a sucker for a catchy tune.
Yeah.
And so something like Honey Pie, which is this sort of pastiche 1920s thing.
Musical.
I loved it when I first heard it.
Yeah.
And now I find it twee and over the top.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? Because I'm a bit the same. And I think in the last podcast, you mentioned you listened to this like 11 or 12. You were fairly young.
Yeah.
So like Revolution 9 freaked you out.
Absolutely. It was terrifying. The album itself, just the sight of it was intimidating to me. Yes,
the pictures. Is it monolithic. The same pictures?
Yeah, same pictures.
Same pictures, yeah.
It was something to do with the black vinyl. And just seemed, you know, when you're smaller, everything seems bigger and more intimidating.
Right.
And it was an example of that. But you're listening to the way Cry Baby Cry goes into this weird little snippet of a McCartney song and then into Revolution 9. It was freaky.
And then into Good Night.
Yeah, Good Night sounds freaky after all of that.
Which I'm not a big fan. I've never been a big fan of the song, but it's a weird way. Obviously, it's an end of an album, so you can get away with it. But it's a weird sort of, I don't know, Ringo's voice, obviously not the greatest singer, but his voice in that has a weird, almost far away, almost...
It does. There's
like a dream.
Yeah, there is version. A distance. There's a point of it. It's like you're the one falling asleep, and it's just in that realm of you're kind of still conscious, but you're drifting.
Yeah.
And it has that distant quality to it.
Yeah.
Which is appropriate to the song. Yeah. It's called Good Night.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's I can't remember whether it's in here that I'm touching the Super Deluxe Edition or elsewhere, but Paul has said that he remembers John demoing the song for Ringo and just, you know, strumming on his acoustic guitar and singing it for him, and said such a beautiful, tender singing, but it wasn't recorded. So it was just a guide thing for Ringo, and he wishes that they'd had the sense to turn the tape machine on.
Right. So I'm looking through the track listing just of the White Album, and like Obladi Oblada.
Again, one that I loved earlier.
Yeah, probably liked it a lot when it was my dad. My dad certainly had the Blue and Red albums of the that were out, the double albums. So that was on there, and I probably enjoyed that. And probably didn't like the weird ones. I think even since, because I was 17 when I bought the White Album, and I was just like, all right, I'm in. This is anything else? Have they got anything? Because it's, and I think one of the things is, too, is the idea that you can have two double albums of music. So you have the Red from 62 to 66 and 66 to 70. You have these two double albums filled with songs. I don't know how many are on there, but let's just, you know, it's like close to 60 across both, maybe more. And yet it's not, you don't know anything about the Beatles listening to it. And that's maybe one answer to Nick's question is, there's best ofs and there's compilations. Well, if you have a compilation of a best of and it's four CDs and that doesn't scratch the surface of the impact of the band and the styles of the band and the just the overall music of the band, then what the hell is this band?
That's one hell of a rich
canon. It doesn't even come close. I would never put those on to listen to, ever.
I don't even know what the track list is for those double albums.
Yeah, I have an inkling, especially of the Red double album first side, because I listened to it a lot. Because my dad had that, those two, he had Abbey Road, he had Sgt. Pepper's. I think that was it.
Yeah.
So I went out of my way to get the Beatles, the White Album, and I just was like, all right, this is, very few of these songs are on those double albums, and yet this is the same band. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. But I think I can't really answer Nick's question, And it's reminded me of something that came up the other day where Justine said, oh, I like the Red Hot Chili Peppers are touring.
Mm.
She was like, do you want to go and see them? And I said, nah, not really. She was like, but you'd love, Blood Sugar Sex Magik, like one of my favorite albums of all time. And she was like, but you love them. And I'm like, no real drive to see them. And she was like, why? And I go, I don't know. It's hard to explain. And she said, but you went and saw Radiohead. And I was like, Radiohead's like in my bones, you know, like that's the difference is that like Red Hot Chili Peppers is that album especially was a huge album. I've listened to it so many times. It's huge in its scope and it's all over the place. It's messy, but it's great and it's funky and it's like, again, the transition for them from where they started to where they were going.
Yeah.
But like, it's not Radiohead. Radiohead's like, oh, they got a new album. I'm listening to it. I'm really listening to it. And I'm listening to it. I'm listening to it. So, and the Beatles are an extension of that. I can't explain. There's no story. There's no story of, oh, I picked this up and it was for me. It's music that was always around. And like Nick said, you play it to your kids. I play it to my kids.
Sure.
And it was always around. And then I guess it sort of grows with you. That's what I mean by in your bones.
Yeah. I think a lot of Beatles music is so familiar from such a young age, it's hard to remember a time when you haven't heard it.
Right.
And that certainly applies for most of the Beatles music to me. Yes. It's even a line from a film called Sliding Doors. Do you remember that?
Gwyneth Paltrow film?
I'm going to
go on the record and say, that's a good movie.
It is a good film. Yeah, she copped a lot of flack for choosing to do that instead of Titanic.
Oh, really?
At the time, because Titanic ended up being such a monster hit. I think Sliding Doors is actually a better film. But there's a line that a character in that film has, which is, everyone knows Beatles songs from such an early age, they should really be called the Feetles.
Right.
And that's very true. But I do have a distinct memory of my dad coming home with a CD player and Revolver on CD.
Nice.
And this would have been the mid-80s.
Nice choice.
when you know, CDs were brand new. Brand new technology, and it was like the first CD that was played in our household. And I remember listening to that album as the first CD I ever heard. And what must have been about 1987, must have been 87, because that's when all the Beatles albums came out on CD.
That's right.
And so I would have been either 7 or 8 years old. And I remember listening to it thinking, this is the single greatest music I've ever heard.
I mean, you'd be hard pressed to argue against that.
I mean, it's hard to think of a better album, song for song, recording for recording, than Revolver.
I would agree. I like this. I like the Beatles' White Album the best, but Revolver's a better album.
Yeah, Revolver is a better album. I would say I'm more fascinated, and you know, come back to the White Album more often than any other Beatles album.
Yeah.
And the more you know about their story, the more interesting the White Album becomes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, as an artistic product, a cohesive whole, Revolver's much better.
And it always annoys me when that's why they make these magazines and things, like any list that has like the top 100, 500 best albums of all time. It's always up there. It's usually third. But Sgt. Pepper's is always ahead of it, which I get, but it's not right. It's just clearly not right.
Yeah. Although I was listening to another podcast. I listened to a lot of Beatles podcasts. That was saying, and it was a really interesting point. I think it might have even been Rob Sheffield, a Rolling Stone journalist who writes a lot about the Beatles. He was saying that there's been such a kind of revisionist anti-Sgt. Pepper attitude for so long that now it's due for rediscovery as a classic again.
It's just got too many. I mean, all right, I'm going to give this to you. This is the track listing for Revolver to. Just to refresh your memory. And I want you to tell me, what's the worst song on this album?
Cool.
What's the least good song on Revolver?
Ah, it's a tough one.
While he's doing that, I'm just going to say there are a couple of songs on Sgt. Pepper's
that you can instantly say, skip that one.
That's not great.
Lovely Rita.
Yeah, Lovely Rita. I would skip that these days. I mean, Good Morning has charm, but it's like whatever. Yeah. I mean, I feel the same about When I'm 64. There's quite a lot of meandering on the album. It's, you know, obviously, we're nitpicking because it's still awesome.
Yeah.
But something like Revolver, if you have a track for track, and if I say to you, what song are you leaving out?
It's tough. If I had to pick one.
Yeah. And you know what? I'm going to guess. And my guess is I have no idea what you're about to
say. I'd probably pick Good Day Sunshine.
Right.
Because these days I find it just a little repetitive.
And again, it's that tweeness of Paul and Kemba.
I'm still a huge fan of Paul McCartney and everything he did, especially in the Beatles.
Yeah.
But it's probably some of his songs that wear out the fastest.
Right, that's probably true. And there's, you know, there are the songs that are catchy as a kid, like Yellow Submarine.
Exactly.
Where you're like, okay, and then as you get older, you're like, it is what it is, but it's not. There's not much meat on the bone of those songs.
Yeah, like
Even Good Day Sunshine, like
it's still an amazing song. We're splitting hairs between things which are incredibly rich and fantastic.
Yeah. I don't know. We went off on a great tangent there, but yeah, Revolver was the album when I moved to England. I had the box set was given to me for my 21st. And
the Norwegian wood box set of CDs with a little roller.
Yeah, with the roller door. It's somewhere in the house, somewhere maybe in the garage. But it's, so I got that. But when I moved to England, that was day two I was in England and had moved into a place where, there's a music shop. Let's go in there. Oh, look, Revolver's £5. I'll grab that and grabbed a few others. But that was the first one. So it's just never... Like it's that, and that to me, I think is as close to timeless as you can get.
Mm.
I don't even think it's of its time.
No.
Whereas I think Sgt. Pepper, you could say, and maybe Sgt. Pepper is very much of its time. But that could be, again, like I said, the mythology behind it could be why we think of it as of its time.
Yeah.
Because it's this stupid image of the 60s, which is like bright and colourful.
Exactly.
The 60s was far from that.
Yeah. And, I mean, if you want to think about Pepper in those terms, then the White Album is really interesting.
Yeah.
Because it's so anti all of those things 1 year later.
Yeah.
Where that's all colourful, this is a plain white.
And everyone's following them. Not everyone, but a lot of people are like, oh, we're going to make our own Sgt. Pepper and we're going to copy their image or we're going to use... And then they go, nope.
Yeah. And where pretty much every song on Pepper is... optimistic. I mean, you could say maybe A Day in the Life,
you know what,
Within You, Without You aren't terribly optimistic, but they're not like negative.
No, even like Fixing a Hole, which is based on like a harsh reality, it's still fixing it.
That's right. And then you listen to the White Album and
that's a good point.
At least every John song, it's he talks about being suicidal. And a lot of them are like that. Even a lot of the Paul songs just have this dark edge to them.
Yeah.
Even when they're optimistic, they're still, you know, trying to find light at the end of a tunnel that you haven't reached yet.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wonder if that's... And it's all pontificating and it could not be true, but if you're meditating for a long time, so a lot of this stuff came out of the
Rishikesh.
The Rishikesh, and they... do a lot of thinking and that from the thinking nearly all of them said apart from like Ringo who bugged it off as quickly as he could that you know they had that space to think and all these songs came pouring out of them but for someone like John to sit and think at any great length of time he was never a positive person you know what I mean and I think that's the at the time one of the things that struck people in general was meditation doesn't mean happiness.
Mm.
You know, meditation isn't happiness. It's thinking.
Yes, it's being more aware.
Yeah, being more aware and more honest. And and the things it brings up isn't always like, enlightenment. It's, I've got all this inside me. I've got to get it out.
Yeah, and I mean, the Beatles and Rishikesh in India is a whole other topic.
Yeah.
And a fascinating one. But a couple of things, I think, happen as a result of that. One very particular type of band goes to Rishikesh.
Right, that's a very good point.
And four individuals come back.
Yeah.
And it's... Huh. I mean, you just look at it logistically. Mm-hmm. Ringo goes home after 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Then Paul goes home after a month.
Yeah.
And then George and John make this commitment to stay.
Yeah.
But then they have this massive falling out with the Maharishi. Yeah. And then leave before they'd intended to.
That's right.
So it's very fractious as a result of that. And then one of the songs that was recorded in demo form and then over 100 times...
Yeah.
For the White Album, but didn't end up making the album, was George's Not Guilty.
How can they do that? How can you? I don't know how.
Because they basically had free reign of Abbey Road.
Yeah, but how do you...
They could do whatever
they want. How are you George, for a start,
and
go, what take are we up to? 73? Right, I'm going to get it this time.
Yeah.
They're going to love it, and it'll be on the album. Like, how? That's something I can't quite fathom, is how someone goes... Oh, you didn't like that version? All right, I will go back and I will work on this 27 more times. Like, it's that kind of stuff I don't quite follow. What? But getting back to this, and one of the things that I've really been so thankful for with the re-release and all of, I was going to say hoo-ha, but it's not massively hoo-ha.
It's only hoo-ha inside the small world of Beatle fanaticism.
One of the things that's fantastic is a lot of the positivity in the recordings.
Yeah.
Because the story of this album was always George's comment of, I was in one studio with a backing band. John was in one studio with a backing band. Paul was in the studio with a backing band. Ringo quits. It's this, like you said, fractious environment.
Yeah.
They're not getting on. They're not recording together. But all of this new tape and all this new... is really great, because you find that the story... becomes the story. A story becomes the story.
Mm.
So a story that someone tells immediately afterwards. John's interview in 1970, he did with...
A Yarn Runner for Rolling Stone.
Yeah, that's right. And all of the stuff he talks about after they've just broken up and he's bitter and angry becomes the story.
Yeah.
Like how he hates all these songs. He hates all this. He's
got John's version of what the Beatles was like
in
1970... sort of by default became the official version for many years.
And it's like, it's always like until a divorce, but you have people who are freshly divorced and you say, tell me about your relationship.
Yeah.
They're not going to be like, oh, it's beautiful. I had a great time. Well, that's right. We had a lovely time and we have this strong connection. They're going to be like, fuck that guy.
And when Wenner decided that he was going to get all of the John interviews from 70 and then publish them as a book.
Yes.
John tried to block it from happening because he knew by that point that those interviews were just him at a very specific moment in time.
Yeah.
And he said, I think, that it was the sound of somebody having hurt themselves saying, ow.
Right. That's
what the interview was. And he didn't want that to be a kind of an official statement.
Yeah.
Years after the fact. And he was feeling more positive about it.
And again, like Paul... had to deal, and I don't know if anyone asks him much about it now, but all through the 70s, I've seen a lot of interviews, YouTube is wonderful for that, where people are like, so how did you feel when John writes, like, how do you sleep at night? And you can, if you watch his interviews, it sort of goes up and down how he feels about it, like, well, you know, he was very angry, or but he's just like, oh, like, how would you feel if someone said this about you, and said that you were Muzak, and all this horrible stuff, but it's that kind of thing, if you... It's the end of a relationship and you go, take us through those previous 8 years. And then everyone just sort of says, that's the story. But so much of all the demo recordings and even the studio recordings, the snippets that I've heard just in the last week of just the obvious collaboration.
Yeah.
Like, it's this thing I've never thought about before, because the story was, oh, they'd all been breaking up. But you still can't make a good album without collaboration. Like, it's... I'm pretty sure it can't be done. It'd be very impressed if someone said, oh, well, we have this. And I think that's a lot of bands like to have that story, or there are stories like that. This band was breaking up and yet they were able to make this masterpiece. But
Yeah, a nice example of that is John's song, Julia.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the best songs on the album, one of my favorite Beatles songs, taking into consideration all of their work. But it's just John and an acoustic guitar. There's nothing else on that recording.
Yeah.
So you could be forgiven for thinking no other Beatle had any involvement in that. And it's an example of four different artists working independently of each other.
Exactly.
But when you listen to a lot of the unused takes and things, you can actually hear that Paul is in the control room coaching John.
The reverse is right in Blackbird.
That's right.
Reverse where he's like, oh, I liked the way you phrased that.
Exactly. And then, so he has a really strong input into the way that track sounded.
Yeah.
Even if they weren't in the room with each other, the very fact that they're still in this band together and that the complex and fascinating dynamic between John and Paul, which, Nick, is another reason why they're endlessly fascinating.
Mm.
I've forgotten the point I was going to make now. Oh, yeah. Say John's writing a song and recording it completely by himself, and then Paul's doing the same in another studio. These are still songs that are written in direct response to each other and with the ambition of trying to impress the other one.
Right.
It's like, I'll write Strawberry Fields, you write Penny Lane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's that drive that pushes them and kept pushing and pushing and pushing, right?
Yeah.
That's why, I mean, ranking albums and all that forever changing, but that's why Abbey Road still holds up, because you can tell, like, oh, you're writing I Want You, She's So Heavy, I'm writing Oh Darling. They're very similar in their design. There's a lot of repetition, and one of the things that I only found out, well, not only found out, but when I listened to the anthologies of Oh Darling, was that I've read, and again, this might be John's, you know, retelling of the story, was that he wanted to be more involved in that song. Because it comes across and it's just Paul singing a lot of it.
Yeah.
But when you hear the rehearsals and you hear the...
The two vocals blending together, it sounds great.
Like, oh, that's, why didn't they do that?
Yeah.
And that's what I first read was, like, John's really pissed off that he wasn't included, but what I've listened to makes me feel like he was like, yeah, it sounded better.
Mm.
It always sounded better
when they're together.
Nick, it always sounded better. The harmonies together, and that's something I think, strangely, that Paul doesn't get enough credit for.
Mm.
Now, my youngest, Noelle, loves Rubber Soul.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing is listening to it with her and getting an appreciation, because she's really listening to it and getting into all the different songs, and I've heard them so many times, is the last few times I've listened to it with her, is the harmonies are unbelievable.
Mm.
Paul McCartney's harmonizing with whoever is singing is
incredible. And George doesn't get enough credit for that. John once called him the invisible singer.
Right on.
Beatles,
yeah,
and that's
that is
a bloody good description.
Way. Yeah.
Because anytime you hear harmonies in Beatles records, George is one of those voices.
Yeah.
And it's so much easier to pick. That's Paul. That's John. John will take the low part. Paul will take the high part.
Yeah.
George is always this sort of blending voice in the middle. Yeah. But really important.
Yeah. And again, like, how you've got this dynamic of John and Paul together making the greatest music ever. And then their harmonies blending together, and then you go, all right, what about that guy over there?
Yeah.
Oh, he's going to, oh, all right, it's going to be even better. Like, it's just the ability of, especially that album, if you listen to Rubber Soul and listen to the harmonies on it and the levels it goes to, and even the little, it might only be like half a bar of harmony, and you're like, oh my god, that's just a knockout little bit they put in there. And anytime you have an isolated track too, that's when you really notice. You're like, oh, I like the guitar playing. John's guitar playing isn't great, but when you just put it all together, it just sounds it's like amazing.
Yeah.
And that's another thing I don't quite get. The obviously, I don't want to use the term magic, but like, that's the whole alchemy of it, I guess, is you've got these, everyone playing and everyone singing, and then when you put it together, you're like, oh, like, I don't know. I don't know what point someone like George Martin's, like, beyond the, oh, yeah, we've got something here, to, like, holy shit, like, this is out of control, good. What do you reckon that was? Do you reckon that was... it wasn't the first album. They bashed it out really quickly.
Yeah, one
they
day.
They knew it was going to be... they knew it was going to be good.
Mm.
Like, they knew it was going to sell. And then maybe it was the second album. Maybe the second album, they came back in and worked.
Mm.
I mean, that's the thing. And listening to, as you said, listening to a lot of Beatles podcasts, the second album... I never really rated that
with
much.
The Beatles.
Yeah, I never really, you know, like whatever, it's pretty much the same as the first one, but I never rated how the improvement in production in such a
they're getting a little more confident in the studio. Yeah. Definitely. I think that's the first album that introduces double tracking vocals, which is a classic Beatles. It's like a signature move on their part.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to get back to something you were saying earlier, yeah. I always found it really interesting that they would do over 100 takes of one track and not even end up using the track on the album.
That's right. Yeah.
Like perfectionism to that degree. But at the same time, they would do a track like Obladi Oblada and suddenly realize, oh shit, we sang the wrong lyrics in one of the choruses and go, oh, leave it in.
Yeah.
Like they'll be so laissez-faire in one way, but so meticulous in another way.
I mean, you got to hide your love away, right?
Mm.
Since you're feeling 2 foot small.
Yeah.
And they're like, you said 2 foot small, 2 foot tall.
Mm.
Oh.
Did I?
Let's just leave that. I'll
good.
Sing
it's
again.
Cool.
Yeah. I'll sing it again and then people will be confused. Like that kind of weird.
It's odd, isn't it?
It's very art student. Like, they're all art students. It's very much like, all right, that's a happy accident. Let's go with it.
But I have to say that their understanding of their own output, their ability to be objective about their own artistic merit, the quality control, for want of a better term, was incredible.
Yeah.
It's hard to think of another band who had a better understanding of what their best work was.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the stuff they left off,
you
completely understand why they left it off, because it's not that good.
Is there? I mean, there's a couple of George songs later on.
Mm.
Sour Milk Sea and...
Sour Milk Sea is a great song.
Yeah, where they don't use it for whatever reason.
I think in... I mean, I...
Even
not,
I Mean Mine? No, I Mean Mine. That's not the one I'm thinking of.
I think in the case of Sour Milk Sea, and this is nothing but my assumption... It was probably too close to Savoy Truffle.
Yeah.
And they had to pick between the two. And I think they made the right choice. Savoy Truffle is, I think, is probably a bit of a better song.
And maybe because I've listened to Savoy Truffle not too much, but more.
Mm.
Maybe I need to leave it.
That's one that I've recently sort of rediscovered, and I love it now.
And that's another thing which I like is... People say, the more you talk about the Beatles, blah, 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 people go, oh, well, I like this song. And you're like, huh. Now, I asked you and a few other people months ago, like, just to annoy you. He's like, tell me your favorite 10, you know, Beatles songs. And I asked you and Tom and Stu, these people who love the Beatles. And so many of you came back with If I Fell.
Mm.
I don't know if that was even in your...
I don't think it was, but I can see.
Yeah, and that was kind of one where I was like, oh, I haven't never really considered.
It is a great song.
And then you listen to it again, you're like, oh, right. I've listened to it as the whole album, and so maybe it gets buried. Sometimes there's songs that, maybe not even with the Beatles, but there might be songs that get sort of buried in the mix of it all. But that one, I was like, oh, If I Fell. And then you listen to it again, you're like, okay. All right, well, I'm going to listen to Savoy Truffle again with a bit more emphasis and see how it comes out, if it comes out any differently. Because that was one song where I was like, I'm not really sure what this song is. It's just listing food and I'm not quite sure what's happening here.
Yeah, no, to me, now it's all about the interplay between George's lead guitar and the horn section.
Okay.
And the way they kind of speak to each other throughout that song is fantastic.
Right.
I'm not even listening to the lyrics anymore.
Right. That's good.
The other song that...
But that's why when you brought up like, oh, I would like, you know, if you had to choose a song, you would get rid of Good Day Sunshine.
Yeah.
All I can hear is the little... which is just, I love it.
Yeah.
And so it's not even the lyrics, it's just the drums. Yeah, exactly. And the bass. Yeah. So it's that kind of stuff. You listen to it enough... You just go, wow, so much depth, there's richness to all of it.
The other George song on the White Album that floors me now that I never used to listen to is Long, Long, Long.
Right, yeah.
Fantastic song. Yeah. And it, again, it's not really the lyrics. It's all about how quiet it is, and then those Ringo drum breaks that just go like cut through the quiet from time to time. It's fascinating to listen to.
Yeah, they've really built, like, it's kind of like, here are these, this is music. You want to know what music is?
Yeah.
Aliens? You want to know what music is? Here. This sort of encapsulates so many different varieties of it.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, like I said, it's not the best album, but or it is the best album, but it's not the best. It's kind of hard to explain.
And the, again, another thing that puts paid to that idea of it being four separate solo artists is if you actually separated out all of Paul's tracks, put them on a single album, all of John's tracks, etc., etc., the dilution is incredible.
That's a very good point.
I, just as an exercise, I tried it once.
Oh, really?
And, you know, if you listen to all of John's tracks in one hit, it still holds up as quite good. All of Paul's, it's not as good.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could put maybe like all of George's and the Ringo ones combined and make an EP.
Yes, that's right.
And, you know, it's not that great, but you put it all together and it's just magisterially great.
Yeah, and I would agree, because I've put, made, you know, mixes or CDs for the girls. Like, all right, I'll put, you like these songs, you like this song, you like a lot of these songs, but when you do that, and I'm just trying to remember which song it was, because this was a while ago, and it was from With the Beatles, and I haven't, I wonder if I can find the actual song, but when you do that, you, all these songs stand out to them that you might not have considered, and the song that stood out for them is It Won't Be Long.
Oh yeah, opens.
Right? Yeah, which opens. And so that was a song where I listened to it, you know, with the Beatles. And again, I hadn't really listened to With the Beatles much, probably the least out of all of them. But hearing people talk on something about the Beatles made me go, all right, I'll listen to it. But that was a song where when you take songs from all different periods and put them on a mix, like you said, it is diluted. It, is, it doesn't have that... continuity and stuff like that, but that was a song which really jumped out to them. Like, can we hear that again? Can we hear that? Can we like, all right, it's double tracked. It's really it's kind of heavy for. So that's what I mean. Like you can hear that it progression from album to album, from the first album to the second album. It's like, are we going to be clear, crisp, and really hit it this time? Probably that first album, you can hear it. It's almost there's almost a bit of restraint there.
Yeah, I mean, they're probably a little bit awed to be in Abbey Road.
As you would. You've got to do it in 10 hours, make an album,
That's right. And in that day and age where all of the technicians wore white coats and they're up in the control room, that's like two stories higher. Yeah. It's a hell of an antiseptic atmosphere to create rock and roll in.
That's a very good way to put it, yeah. And then, and then of course, like when your first album comes out and it sells well, then you go, all right.
Yeah.
All right, we know what we're doing. But to have that confidence, to not be just like, oh, we know what we're doing, but I think this is where that Hamburg experience really, I think they spent a lot of time in Hamburg going, if we make it, it'll be, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
And so then they make it and they're not like, all right, we're not, they don't go straight to excess. They go straight to the work, which is that unusual? I don't know.
I don't know that it's unusual, but it's definitely a hallmark of people that I admire. It's
people that excel.
I see it in like writers and actors I like as well. It's not about the byproduct of the work, which is fame or fortune, as nice as these things can be.
Yeah,
there are certain types of people that I really gravitate towards who recognize that the work is its own reward.
Yeah.
And that's what it's really all about. Actors like Mark Rylance.
Of course.
I think he understands it's about the work.
And they work. And they work. There's no, but like you said, 14 albums, 7 years.
Yeah, it's insane, isn't it, by today's standards? No one has that rate of productivity.
Did they have it before that?
I don't know. Yeah, everyone makes comparisons to things that happened afterwards.
Yeah.
Because the Beatles, in so many ways, created the blueprint,
it's the blueprint
for a rock group to follow.
Because when they started, the expectation is that a band lasts 2 years.
Yeah, something like that.
Like, it's not...
The popular phrase was, you know, what are you going to do when the bubble bursts?
That's right. Like, oh, and I think in one of their first, maybe when they went to America, though, like, oh, maybe, you know, maybe, I know it might have been sooner than that. Like, oh, hopefully in like 2 years we'll still have a band. And, you know,
that's right.
And that might have been on the BBC.
Yeah, yeah, there are a series of famous interviews. I think it's just in 1963. So if they're big as an act in Great Britain. It's not Beatlemania yet. And they're already talking about what are you going to do when the bubble bursts.
That's classic British.
Yeah, I know.
Like, this won't last forever. You can't be this happy.
Yeah. And John has this extraordinary moment where he says, well, you can be big-headed and say we're going to last 10 years.
Wow, wouldn't that be amazing?
Yeah, and here we are 50 years later.
Yeah, still obsessed. Just
talking about the White Album. Somebody once said, the extraordinary thing about the Beatles, Nick, is that they got to the absolute apex of fame and entertainment, music, whatever you want to call it. And the only way you can go from there is down.
Yeah.
And so then the next question is, when is that going to start happening? But it's hard to think of another band in musical history that other than the Beatles, that has reached that apex and somehow miraculously just got bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
And it has never stopped.
That's right. It's true. Like, what's the falling down was...
It never happened.
People could argue it's Let It Be, but it's not.
No.
Because it happened before.
That's right. They'd already broken up.
That's right. And it was actually done before one of their great albums. Like, it's just, mind-boggling.
Yeah.
One of the things as well, which is just not a gripe, but one thing that I'm waiting for is the one thing that's very underrepresented is 1963 when it comes to the Beatles. You've got their build-up. We know all about their build-up and their time in Hamburg.
Yeah.
And huge amount of footage, publicity from going to America. And
64
being their year and coming to Australia. There's so much footage. And I think Ron Howard's documentary.
Yeah.
Whatever it's called.
That's right. If you watch Ron Howard's documentary, you'd be forgiven for thinking the Beatles were a kind of nothing band until they arrived in New York.
But I want to know that 63 year. Very, very few books and anything I've read or seen. I mean, the anthology, DVDs, even very little footage from that time. So it's kind of like 63, we toured around and it was, you know, we went here and we went here and we went to France. And but it's like,
I don't know
what happened. When you exploded, took over the country. Why is there no, why don't we have any reporting of this? But it's like America, saturation, they loved it. And then it's, from then on, it's, they were followed everywhere. But before that, it's not like 63 was a quiet year for them.
No.
It wasn't like they were building. They were already enormous.
That's
all of a sudden. And so, but that's, like I said, that's just a personal gripe. Now, I've got another question. Question two from Nick.
We're up to question two.
Yeah.
Right.
There's three questions, so we're doing all right. And the third question is, I think, a fairly much easier question. This is more difficult, and we might pause and play some music while we try and think of this. Someone says, I don't care much for the Beatles. I don't understand why they have their reputation, right?
Uh-huh.
Pick one or two, etc., songs that you would play to change their opinion. Now, I've thought about this already because I've thought about students saying this, like, oh, yeah, the Beatles, whatever, yeah. And the real question is, you don't know the Beatles. Like I said before, you can have four CDs of their greatest hits.
Yeah.
And it's not good.
That's right. I think anyone who says that and has a passing familiarity with the Beatles has probably heard all of the hits and has been left cold by
yeah,
them.
Yeah, and I get that.
So you probably have to go for some deep cuts. Especially
a lot of the early hits as well. I think a lot of the early hits you would hear, you'd be like, oh, this is just a...
So, I mean, I don't know what this guy or girl is, what music they like. Yeah. So I'd be tempted to try and find something in the Beatles catalogue that's similar.
Right.
Because you can do that so easily. But without knowing that, some deep cuts that I'd probably go to are maybe Helter Skelter. I don't know whether they've heard that.
Yeah.
But that's some Beatles at their most heavy.
Uh-huh. When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. Where I stop and I turn and I go for a ride. Till I get to the bottom and I see you again. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But do you, don't you want me to love you?
There's a, I'm thinking just in terms of White Album tracks at the moment, but there's a McCartney track on the White Album called Mother Nature's Son that I find fantastic.
Yeah.
I love that song, and it's not a terribly well-known one if you're not a real fan. I don't know. Do you have anything that
This is what I would do. I would put on From Me to You.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would put on Tomorrow Never Knows.
You're trying to say the difference between these.
This is the same band.
Yeah.
Here is From Me to You. Here is Tomorrow Never Knows.
Yeah.
That's the Beatles. So if you want to draw a line between From Me to You, this pop song, pure pop, and then Tomorrow Never Knows, this far out psychedelia, and you draw a line, I can tick off every connector in between those two songs.
Yeah, that's a good point. They're sort of bookends of culture, popular culture and music.
Yeah.
And it's a way of illustrating the point that you might think the Beatles fit inside this particular box and you don't like what's in that box and you like what's over here.
Yeah.
But I guarantee you that what you're looking at and you're interested in, the Beatles have touched and have influenced.
Exactly.
We
right.
just need to find the bit of the Beatles that would appeal to you.
Exactly right. And I've said to students as well, if John Lennon was still alive, he would be claiming, I created hip-hop.
Mm.
He'd be claiming, look, I made Revolution Number 9. It's just breakbeats and just sampling and all that stuff. I did that. I'm sure he wasn't the first one to do that. But that's what he'd probably would be claiming. That would be part of his thing.
Yeah.
But that's certainly what I do, because if the question's about why they have the reputation, it's as far from the spectrums as you can possibly get.
Exactly.
It's the same band.
Yeah.
And you can play Tomorrow Never Knows in class first. You know, I'm going to listen to a song and play it. And the people who haven't ever heard it before go, what? I'm like, what is this?
If there's anything that you want, if there's anything I can do, just call on me and I'll send it along with love from me to you. I got everything that you want.
But I wonder if there are songs that you can play that you can say, when was this made? And people have no idea. I don't know if that's possible, because obviously I know every Beatles song and I know when it was released.
Yeah, probably a bit too close to it myself to be able to.
But I wonder if you could play certain songs and go, is this new? And whether or not people could guess. I was thinking Helter Skelter as well. That'd be another one. Well, it's this song and it's this song. And what about Helter Skelter here? That's fairly new.
Yeah. And maybe I Want You, She's So Heavy from Abbey Road.
Love it.
I seem to be gravitating towards some of the heavier ones.
I've always been one of my favorites.
Yeah. Talk about like Lennon inventing genres that would come after. I feel like he's inventing heavy metal with that song.
Inventing Deep Purple,
yeah,
without a doubt.
Mm.
But it's yeah, that song in particular. I've always, I don't know why, and that's another one. Like, there's so many songs. Where people, why do you like this song? I don't know. It's just, you can keep listening to it, and sometimes you listen to it, you hear the bass. Sometimes you listen to it and just hear the lead. Sometimes you listen to it and hear the drums. And just sometimes you go, why is there a tempo change in the middle of the song? Why not?
Yeah, yeah.
Again, oh, did we? Did we record it at two different speeds? Sounds good. That'll do.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe thinking a little bit earlier. Let me try and think of an earlier Beatles song that's not that well known that might reveal charms to someone who's over familiar with a lot of hits.
But again, it depends what people like. And I remember the joy of getting that Redbox box set and finding a song like I've Just Seen a Face, which I've never heard. Never heard it on the radio. No one ever told me, oh, it's a good Beatles song.
Yeah.
And just going, oh my God, it's amazing.
I'll tell you what song I really love that's quite early. It's on A Hard Day's Night. It's a McCartney song called Things We Said Today.
Right, yeah.
And I love the mental headspace that song comes from,
which
is experiencing a moment of real joy and happiness and then getting into a strangely reflective and melancholy state thinking about what it might be like in the future when you're not as happy, remembering what's happening right now. What an extraordinary thing to write a song about. And he actually captures that mood perfectly.
Yeah. But he also captures it in like something like I'll Follow the Sun, where you're like, oh, right, like I don't care, it's fine, but he clearly does care. It's that kind of thing, oh, well, you know, whatever, today's raining or tomorrow it's going to rain, but I don't care, I'll follow. And it's kind of like one day, it's a lot, one day you'll know that I was the one.
Yeah.
Like, right on, man. That's a brave thing to put out there.
Yeah.
Like,
I think that's the best song on Beatles for Sale.
Yeah, I like that one as well. I mean, Beatles for Sale was another one where at a certain point in my life, I like listened to a lot. I don't know. And again, I was happy I got that box set for my 21st, so I could sort of listen. I wonder if my listening experience was like, oh, all right, I'm 28, so this album's resonating to me. But I think Beatles for Sale was an early 20s album for me. It was like, oh yeah, this is I'm a Loser and Babies in Black and all of these real quite dark songs.
Yeah,
where again you could play for people and go, oh, like the Beatles aren't. Again, what you think, they might not be what you think they are. They're not, and like even as you said, like with something like Sgt. Pepper's, it's very positive. And even Paul has said, you know, like all our albums, you know,
peace, love,
peace and love. That's what we promoted. Ringo, that's all it says now. It seems is peace and love.
I know.
But they had that a lot of songs that were like you said, and even on the Beatles where, you know, I'm suicidal, but even far earlier than that, he's singing like I'm a Loser. Like that's a pop song. You can sing a pop song about how you're not what you appear to be and that you're really sad inside. And even something like Help, like he writes Help and it's somehow they make it into a pop hit.
Yeah.
And it's Help. Listen to the words of the song.
Yes. Even if you take into account all of the Beatles songs that have that hurt or frustration, negativity, whatever you want to call it, into account, the weight of the Beatles canon is still overwhelmingly life-affirming.
Yeah, without a doubt.
And I think that's a strong point in their favor. I think that's what Paul is talking about when he says, you know, hardly any of the songs are, you know, go on, kids, tell your parents
to
piss off or whatever. And it's all peace and love. I think what he means is it's ultimately life-affirming.
Oh, without a
doubt. Have you ever read a Martin Amis novel called The Rachel Papers? It's his first novel. It's about a guy in his 20s being obsessed with sex and trying to seduce women. And this girl's going to come up to his apartment and he's doing that thing of artfully arranging everything in the best possible
way.
Anything, he suddenly has this moment of panic thinking what music should be playing when she comes into the apartment and is looking through his record collection, agonizing, and eventually he settles on a Beatles album with the completely justifiable reasoning that to be against the Beatles is to be against life.
Right. Without a doubt. Like, it's, I mean, I don't know if I've ever met anyone who's like, oh, yeah, I don't like the Beatles, or like these questions that, that Nick has asked. I haven't encountered that. I haven't encountered anyone to be like, oh, really? You like the Beatles? Or they're overrated? I mean, I'm sure there are people that think that.
Mm.
Because why wouldn't you? If you don't like them, then you would think that.
I mean, if they are the most popular and, you know, celebrated band ever, of course there's going to be a contingent of people who choose to dislike them simply for that reason.
But here's a, maybe another point to that first question. What makes them so good is that is, as far as I've noticed, is a much smaller amount than I would normally consider appropriate for, like, just in general, people to want to go against the grain. You know what I mean? There's far less. If this is the most popular, most appreciated band of all time, wouldn't there be more people? Wouldn't there be more happily vocal about how they're overrated? I don't think I've encountered many people like that.
Yeah, I mean, I've known one or two.
Yeah.
But when I've said, so why don't you like them? They've just sort of sniffed and said, well, it's because everyone else bloody loves
them.
Right.
Which is fair enough.
Yeah.
Everyone does. It seems to be the case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes I do feel a little bit like it. There's a predictability to it. I'm slightly embarrassed at being such a Beatle nerd because the thing that I've chosen to be fanatical about is generally celebrated as the greatest thing ever.
Yeah, but
I could have chosen something more obscure.
Yeah, true. But it is nice, and I'm sure you would agree with me, and I'm sure Tom Griffiths would agree with me, that it is a nice thing to be obsessed about because there is just so much information and thought put towards it.
Yeah.
Because if it was obscure, then you'd really have to do a lot of digging.
Yeah.
And talking to you, I'm sure you have done a lot of digging. It hasn't been just like what's other people saying. But it is nice to have such a broad, like, spectrum of stuff. And even again, like, and we spoke about in the last podcast, is I got into the Beatles within 6 months, announcement, anthology series coming out, new, whatever it was, 8-hour TV series, or what, I don't know what ended up being on TV, but, you know, I've since got the DVDs and have it on my computer.
Yeah.
And again, we'll every now and then just, oh, I've got that. I might just watch the first, I've sat down and watched the whole lot.
Yeah.
Like 8 hours worth or 10 hours of the Beatles, is that there, it was this thing where I'm like, oh, I've got into this album, and then all of a sudden, they're back. Mm. That was a really fortuitous thing. It was like, oh, there is so much stuff that I have to learn.
Mm.
But you just want to just, like, you know, soak it up as much as possible.
Yeah. I find the anthology, I mean, it's the curse of becoming so nerdy about this thing that you end up being as critical of product as you are, you know, in love with it. And the anthology is a classic example.
Yeah.
I mean, I love it for certain things. Like, it's the only place where you can still see certain sections of Let It Be era footage that look really good.
Yeah.
So I'll watch it for that reason alone. But there are other elements of it that will frustrate me because I know you're spinning a particular version of events here that probably isn't actually the closest thing to truth.
Yeah.
An example of that is Paul insisting, you know, we always decided we wouldn't go to America until we had a number one, which is utter bullshit.
Yeah.
The concerts were arranged, the hotels were booked, and it was coincidental that they had a number one here.
Yeah.
Another example is this idea that the Let It Be sessions ended up in this fiasco, and then, you know, they had to let everything settle, and then eventually they all decided, well, let's make one final great album before we all break up.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything like that.
Yeah.
One, they didn't know it was going to be the last album.
Yeah.
That was still very much like, well, let's keep one foot in the door. We don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that the sessions that ended up constituting Abbey Road started like 2 weeks after the Let It Be one's finished.
That's right.
So there was virtually no break at all.
Yeah. It's not like they went, all right, we're all different. Now we all like each other and everything's fine. Like, it's Yeah, and again, that's I think we spoke about it before, was the idea that, oh, at this stage, they're in their Sergeant Pepper's phase, and here they're in this phase.
It's very much after the fact that you apply those labels to certain periods.
They're like, right, and then, and, you know, like they're not like, all right, now we're going to be psychedelic. Yeah. We've done that. Now what's next? Like,
it's not how people live lives.
No, that's right. And it's interesting that is the... There has to be a narrative. Like, it's much easier to build a narrative into it after the fact.
Exactly.
But someone like Mark Lewisham's book, like Tune In, was the first time where you're reading, going, oh, thank God, I don't know how much work he's put into it, obviously. Oh,
decades.
And you read it and you're like, oh, this feels like exactly what happened.
Yes.
Without the glibness of, we went to Heber, the end. Well, we did this at the end, but it's like...
It's not a work of journalism. It's a historical work.
Yeah.
And there's no agenda behind the writing of the text. And in this day and age, when so many hundreds of books have been written about the Beatles, the only way that a publisher will fund a new Beatles book is if there's some sort of angle to it.
Yeah, like, some salacious
It's going to be a hatchet job on what an awful person John Lennon was or something like that.
Yeah.
And there's usually like one new tidbit of information
that
then colours the rest of his life according to this version of the story.
Exactly
right. Lewisham doesn't do that.
No.
He's very meticulous about providing different angles, but he doesn't tell you what you should think about this.
No.
And I've never read a Beatles book about the second half of their career that doesn't paint Alan Klein as a villain.
Right.
And Lewisham has already said, by the time I get to writing those, I'm not going to tell you what you should think about Alan Klein.
Yeah, and that was the thing. The first bit was for all the... like discussion of how they start and all this stuff, was that it was fair on everyone. Like you said, there's no slant, not like this, because that's what tends to come out. Paul is this person and Johnny is this person, because we need the four people to fit like a jigsaw puzzle.
That's right.
And the story has to fit together. But that's not, like you said, that's not what life is. Life isn't just, I met these people. We just clicked together and then everything just... went in one direction.
We decided, let's go and make 14 albums.
That's right. Let's make 14 albums in 7 years and then, and then split up and then we'll be fine.
Yeah.
And everything will be great. Now, I've got one last question.
Okay.
Before we wrap it up, it's been very enjoyable, I've got to say. Obviously, could do this for 10 hours. And this is the last question from Nick. Total hypothetical question. A totally unknown, never heard before Beatles track is announced and soon to be released. What album session do you secretly hope it is from and why?
Okay. Interesting question. I'd probably say Abbey Road.
Right.
Because there is so little in terms of leftover material from that final period.
Yeah.
And I'd be fascinated by the thought of a suddenly discovered gem from those sessions.
Because a lot of them you were writing and then taking it with them as well with Abbey Road.
Yeah.
Any songs that came out in those sessions, like John had Jealous Guy, what was it called? Can't remember. Child of Nature. You know, George had three albums worth of stuff, and Paul had McCartney, and, fairly quickly. So a lot of anything came from there. But yeah, that's a good one, because I was just going to go straight to Revolver, like the best album, like no filler in that album. Very, I don't know, any like weak tracks that might be there, to have a song from that period, like what if it was as good as something on that album? So like that's probably what I'd go, I think.
Yeah. Just
take their best album, if there was a track on that.
Yeah. I mean, in reality, if it was suddenly announced Lost Beatles track, suddenly discovered, my first reaction would be skepticism.
Yeah, of course.
I'd think, I've probably heard of it.
I should have said that, Nick.
And the reason why it's lost is that it's not that good to begin with.
Yeah.
I mean, on the White Album, I know of a couple of tracks that were recorded that still have not seen the light of day. There's a McCartney song called Etc.
Right.
That no one has ever heard before.
There's a reason why
we haven't heard it. Yeah, there's a reason why we haven't heard it. It's McCartney himself has said it was shit.
So once you have that out of the way, yeah, there's very few. There's no bootlegs floating around where people are like, what is this? Why didn't we ever hear that song? Because they're just not never as good.
That's right.
If they're all like noodling about songs, they just don't get them.
Yeah. I like the fact that we now have a proper release of the Isha demos.
Yeah.
Because those are really, really solid. Yes. They're fascinating to listen to. And there's versions of songs that had no official Beatles release before, right, like right. Junk,
yeah.
Child of Nature, Circles, Sour Milk Sea.
Yeah, it's Come and Get It on.
No, that's an Abbey Road era
right,
track.
Okay.
And that's a great track.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I said before, their quality control was so good that I'm instantly skeptical that anything lost was lost for a reason.
Right. Right. Yeah, without a doubt, they never put their name to anything that they.
Yeah, they knew what
maybe not
to release.
Mystery Tour. I don't know the movie. I don't know. Some people like
they didn't
movie.
Know what they were doing with things outside of music.
No,
and they can be forgiven for being arrogant in that respect. Where at least in their musical careers, they had so many people saying, "You don't understand the music business. What you need to do is X," and they'd say, "Well, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to do the opposite of that." Yeah. And suddenly, they're a brilliant success.
Yeah.
So that would naturally lead you to think, "I know how to do anything intuitively and brilliantly." And they didn't realize until they made Magical Mystery Tour that formula really only existed when they were making music.
Yeah, and I think it only really existed. One of the few times where it only really existed in their minds or in Paul's mind or who's ever was like, oh, I've got this great concept.
Mm.
Everything I've thought of so far has been
awesome. Amazing. Yeah.
So it's not really a fall, is it? But I think at that point people are like, oh, it's over. They made something and people didn't like it. This is great. But then they're like, all right, we're just going to make a double album now.
Mm.
Now, I tried to look it up this week, but the details are sketchy. The Beatles, a white album, in brackets, is the highest selling album.
Yeah.
But is that because there's two discs?
Yes. And it's a technicality.
Right.
It counts as two albums.
Right.
Every sale.
Yes.
That's why it's the highest selling album.
Right. And that's it.
That's it.
That is so dumb. I'm like, oh, it's the best selling. Because I tried to find it and it wasn't clear on a lot of sites. It was like, well, these are the numbers, but it's like how many... Are you just saying this is how many albums were sold?
Mm.
I might look up George's All Things Must Past and House and see...
Triple
album, exactly. Like, how did that go? But, okay, we're going to wrap it up now. And I was just going to ask you, is there an album you listen to maybe... Are there albums you listen to based on mood? Like, what is the mood of this album for you, not for the album?
I will listen to the White Album when I want to really immerse myself in the Beatles and focus 100% on the music I'm listening to.
Right.
And when I'm really interested in their personal story, I think the White Album is the one that, for me, is the most closely linked to what was happening in their lives at the time and at this point in history. Even taking into consideration things we were saying about how Sgt. Pepper is so linked to its time, this album is too, but in a very different way. I can't listen to a track and not think about what was happening in Paul's life and what the atmosphere, like the fractious relationship might have been between him and George at this point in time.
Yeah.
So I kind of listen to it when I'm thinking about that.
There's a lot of John writing songs about Yoko as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is like, huh, this is new. Mm. And then maybe that's what makes the album, makes certainly John's songs have that sort of crackle to it, is that there's this new thing in his life.
Mm.
And he's just like, and it's not, this is new in my life, I'm going to write a love song. It's, there's a new thing in my life.
Yeah.
And I'm going to write Happiness is a Warm Gun and then put bits about Yoko in it.
Mm.
Like, it's kind of, I mean, she's avant-garde. So he's kind of trying, I think, to do in some song. And I guess that's what makes the album so great, is that you can't go in this album, John is doing this or Paul is doing this, because they're just like, well, we've got wings now.
Mm.
Watch, see how far we can fly with these.
Mm.
And we can go in all directions.
Yeah. I suppose if I'm feeling, you know, buoyant and excited, I'll listen to something from quite early on, like With the Beatles or yeah. A Hard Day's Night. If I'm feeling nostalgic, I'll probably listen to Abbey Road.
Yes. I think I've said this. It's probably the thing I've said most on this podcast, but I was listening to that as a 17-year-old. My dad was like, just gave me the look that he always gives me and just said, you're either in love or you're depressed. And I was like, God damn it. It's both.
It's both.
It's both, yeah.
It's both.
Yeah.
It's because they're all there.
Yeah.
It's still the Beatles, but at the same time, you know, this is it. This is the final hurrah.
But I was. I think that comes through in the music, because
absolutely.
That was, even before my concept of the Beatles arc, was that was one of the few CDs in our house that was the Beatles, and listening to that, and that's what Dad said. Like, that's the only time he listened to it. When he was in love, when he was sad, when he put Abbey Road on.
Mm.
I've never made that connection, but at the time it was true. But now, like, I'm with you, it's a very nostalgic album.
It's hard to really put
your that's what on. I mean, like, it's in the bone, so there's things that I can't put my finger on. There's no I don't have memory attached to a lot of the albums. Not like, oh, this is this part of my life, because it's continuous. It's always evolving, and they're just always there.
Yeah.
And that's a thing that it wasn't said of the Beatles, but I can't remember who said it or what song they were talking about, but they were like, when I put this album on, it's like a visit from an old friend.
Yeah.
And when the opening bars of Dear Prudence comes on, that's exactly how I feel.
Well, just while I think of it, another thing that's really specific to the mood Abbey Road, or at least the mood you're in when you listen to it, is that Abbey Road gives you a glimmer of what the Beatles would have sounded like if they'd kept going.
Right.
It's the only album that doesn't sound like really 60s Beatles, but almost sort of points the way forward for a 70s Beatles future direction.
Like a jam band.
That's right. it just sounds much more modern.
Right.
It's the only one that was mixed in stereo and not in mono.
Yeah, without a doubt.
And it has like Moog synthesizers on it. It actually sounds like a different, more contemporary band.
It's clean, right?
It's clean.
Crisp or something.
Yeah,
or something
it almost sounds like 80s in that respect.
Right.
So I suppose, without wanting to sound too pompous about it, which I'm guilty of a lot of the time, I admit, it's an album that's in the subjunctive mood.
Right.
Because you listen to it and it's hard not to think, what if?
Right.
What if they'd made an album in 1980? What if they'd made, if they'd just done like an album in 1971?
Right.
And imagine it had been on it, and you know, all that kind of stuff. Because it's an album for creating, for that sort of headspace.
Right.
It's the what if headspace.
It's moving towards something, hopefully.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely, as always.
And that's it. I know that you won't leave me no more.